accession number 18750, real one.
Graham Scopes, real one. Where were you born, please?
Frinton-on-Sea.
Which year was this?
October 1920.
Did you grow up in Frinton and have your education there?
I didn't grow up in Frinton. My father was a building contractor, and his business was at Clacton-on-Sea. And when I think when I was 2 years old, the family moved to Clacton, where I did grow up. And I went to school locally at the Clacton County High School.
How old were you when you finished your schooling?
17.
So this is 37?
Yeah, 37.
Did you get a job?
Yeah, I went. I worked for my father until war broke out.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did indeed.
Under what circumstances?
At home. The actual circumstances, I can't recall.
And what were your personal feelings when you heard the news of the outbreak of war?
By that time I was in the territorials, and I was 18, and I just couldn't wait for war to break out. I was, you know, keen to get in the army.
Why was this?
One of my father's clerks was he lost a leg in the First World War, and being an impressionable youngster, he was telling tales of service life in the First World War, and I was fascinated by it.
So it didn't disturb you?
Didn't disturb me one little bit.
Were you in any early bombing of England by the German Air Force?
No, I was mobilised in the August, I suppose the fortnight before war was actually declared. I was mobilised at Colchester. I only came across early bombing when I was on leave from the Essex Yeomanry, long before I joined the Airborne Regiment.
What was your experience in the Essex Yeomanry?
We were... No overseas service. We were doing vulnerable point guards, railway stations, electrical places, and field gun practice.
Field gun practice?
Yeah, we were 25 pounders, and we were stationed in the country, and we used to have gunnery practice most weeks.
So it was really an artillery unit.
Royal Horse Artillery.
Whereabouts was this guard duty?
King's Cross Station. Croydon. I just can't remember what we were guarding at Croydon. Some installation in Leicester Square.
So in the home counties?
In the home counties.
What was the atmosphere in the country like at the time of Dunkirk?
It was pretty gloomy. Really and truly, it was pretty gloomy. And during the early days, gloom used to descend on the regiment when great battleships were lost. And I can recall, I think it was Renown going down. Oh no, it was the Hood going down. And the atmosphere was in those early days quite gloomy.
Did you ever think that the Germans were going to win?
I don't think we ever thought that. going on a bit, in the prisoner of war camp, we had a secret radio, and we used to get we used to get messages, and once again the mood went up and down. Sometimes it was, you know, we thought, you know, we'll be out tomorrow. Other times we thought, well, this is going to drag on forever.
Did you ever listen to Churchill's speeches?
Yes, we did.
What effect did they have on you?
Oh, they were always enlightening. Everybody felt a surge of optimism after hearing Churchill.
And Lord Haw Haw?
Yes, we did hear him, but I think he was a joke. I think most of the service people in my regiment thought he was a joke.
How much soldierly training did you get with the Essex Yeomanry?
Oh, not a great deal. We did some parade ground marching and small arms drill, but in those early days, I was a driver. I drove the, I think they were called quads, which towed the guns.
What did you think of the Essex Yeomanry as a unit?
Oh, great. It was a territorial unit. We were friends with the socially with the officers, and it was just like a family, actually.
What did the attitude of the civilian population in England seem to be towards units like yours at that time?
Oh, absolutely. I was stationed in Colchester, which was one of the great army towns, and they were used to, you know, they'd been used to the army for many, many generations. Oh, we were accepted entirely.
So why did you not stay with the unit?
Well, we appear to be going nowhere. It was training, and there seemed to be no signs of the unit going overseas. And why I changed, recruiting chaps came round, trying to get people for the airborne division, and two, potential officers for the Indian Army. And I was young. I didn't fancy the Indian Army, and I volunteered for the airborne side of it. Three of my chums volunteered to go training for Indian Army officers, and two of them never returned. They were captured and killed in Singapore.
So how did you go about leaving the regiment for another unit?
Oh. I would, you know, we were called before the CO, a Major Perkins, and he wanted to know why. And I told him that, you know, there seemed to be little action, and he was very sympathetic and agreed. I was the only one out of our unit that did volunteer for the airborne.
When would this have been?
Must have been early 43.
Was there anything in particular that attracted you to the airborne?
No, it nothing really. I thought it'd be an exciting sort of life and a change from the good old Royal Horse Artillery.
And what was the procedure once you'd volunteered?
Once I volunteered, we did an intensive course at Hardwick. And I think it was about a 5 or 6 week, everything on the double, an intensive course of really physical training there. And then we were passed out, and off we went to Ringway, which I believe is now Manchester Airport. And we did, I suppose it was a 6 week course there. I'm not certain about that. We all I am certain about, we did two balloon drops, and three out of the old Hamdens or Hadley Page, I think they were, rickety old aircraft.
How did you cope with what you were expected to do?
Quite well. I personally had no difficulty at all.
Any incidents that happened to you either at Hardwick or Ringway?
No incident had happened to me, but there was a Polish stick dropping, and apparently one of the Polish paratroopers decided not to jump. In those days, before you qualified, you could unhook your parachute and go to the back of the the aircraft. Well, this chap did just that, but then decided that he would jump and forgot to hook himself up, and of course he died instantly. That was a bit of a black mark, and I think that shook quite a lot of the people on my course.
Did any of them drop out as a consequence?
There were two or three people that did drop out, and as I say, they were absolutely entitled to it until they had done their five drops, and then they were just RTU, return to unit.
How was that regarded?
Well, you know, I think most people had a certain amount of sympathy with them, but I must admit they were soon forgotten.
What was the next step?
The next step, we were sent to the 2nd Battalion, but where we were at the time, I honestly can't remember.
Don't worry too much
about
that.
My memory comes clearly back after we went to Grantham, where we trained for the eventual Arnhem drop.
Can you take me through that, please?
Well, in the preparation for Arnhem, we had one parachute drop, only one, which went quite successfully. And then we did ordinary, small arms and field training.
Could I just interrupt you there? Yeah. You said we. Can you clarify who you mean
we? I'm sorry. The second, I was in A Company of the 2nd Battalion, and when I say we, that means just that. A Company.
And which subdivision of A Company were you in? Do you remember?
I was in number one platoon.
Do you remember anything about the leadership of the unit?
Yes. The lieutenant in charge was a chap called Lieutenant Roberts. The colonel of the 2nd Battalion was, of course, Lieutenant Colonel Johnny Frost.
And what rank did you hold?
A corporal.
What were your responsibilities as corporal?
The platoon sergeant was Sergeant Ernest Ballinger, and I was his second. I was his full corporal.
So you were telling me about the preparations.
As I say, we did one parachute drop, and the rest was purely small arms drill, marching, and that was about all. I believe that we were going to be chosen for the second front. I believe so, but that was obviously cancelled. And while the second front was taking place, we were at Grantham, and I was drinking beer in the Naffy when the second front planes went over.
What kind of briefing did you have before Arnhem about where you were going and about what to expect?
Oh, there was two or three quite elaborate briefings. There was the final one was a sand table with the Arnhem layout, the dropping zone, the bridge and the surrounding country. And we had two or three sessions at that.
Did you know it was Arnhem you were going to?
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. At the very last briefing, we knew it was Arnhem.
And what was your unit supposed to do once you landed?
Well, the battalion, I can only speak for A Company. We were destined, we were going to be the first in, which we were, and we were to make our way to the bridge.
Can you tell me about the loading of the aircraft, please?
It was a beautiful day. We were taken in coaches to the local airfield in Lincolnshire. And once again, I cannot recall the actual name of the airfield. You'll probably know that. We were issued with sandwiches, and the mood was quite light-hearted. It was a beautiful, beautiful sunny day, and we were loaded up. Colonel Frost came along to each aircraft and wished us well, and at whatever hour it was, we took off, and off we went to Arnhem.
What equipment were you carrying yourself?
I was carrying a Sten gun and the full traditional pack with emergency rations, ammunition, two or three hand grenades.
Were you happy with what you were carrying?
Oh, yes. Yes, we were. Yes. Yes, at that moment, we were happy. It was obvious as the campaign went on that we couldn't maintain a successful campaign against what the Germans eventually threw at us, Tiger tanks and such like.
What was the flight across like?
Fine, no trouble at all. We were escorted by fighter aircraft. No problem at all. And the actual drop was unopposed. Absolutely a clear... I believe there were no casualties at all on the actual drop.
Did you land all right?
Yes, no problem at all.
In what kind of terrain?
Oh, a flat plateau. An ideal dropping zone.
Was it cultivated?
No, it wasn't. It was just, grass.
And then what?
Well, we'd had instructions what to do with parachutes. We bundled the parachutes together and pushed them under whatever bushes that were near and handy. I mean, many of them just left them where they were. And we had instructions to make our way to the bridge, which we did. Once again, to start with, there was no trouble at all. We, as a matter of fact, on the way, we did take three or four prisoners, German prisoners. We had a little bit of small arms fire against us, but we coped with that quite well. As we went, as we pushed on, we did come across a track vehicle, which we didn't attack it. We dived into the side. But I think the first casualty of the campaign was a chap called Private Gibson, and he was killed by this vehicle.
Did you see this?
Yes, I did.
What happened?
Oh, he was he's instead of staying put, he shot away from the country terrain and shot into the road. And as he was running, I think he could have panicked. He was, mowed down there and then.
How were these prisoners taken? Did you see that?
Yes, they gave themselves up immediately. And there were certain members of the company were instructed to take whatever prisoners to a compound. I don't know how that was arranged, because you know we were still pushing on.
What do you remember next? Or had you come across civilians?
Ah, now from then on we started. We couldn't take the route that was actually planned for us, so we had to divert. We went along a railway track and then through back gardens of houses. That's when we first came across civilians, and they were absolutely overjoyed to see us. They came out with apples and drink, milk and biscuits. Because I believe the poor old Dutch civilians really thought that they were going to be liberated.
And then?
Then we had one or two skirmishes on the way, but it was getting dark by the time we got to the bridge. And Captain Franks was a chap I remember mostly. We commandeered a house overlooking the bridge with civilians in it. They weren't terribly pleased with all that, so we took over this house with windows overlooking the entrance to the bridge.
What was the house like?
Oh, nice. very nice. I believe it was one of these three-storied houses. A very nice house.
What did the civilians say about your commandeer?
They weren't happy, but I think it was Franks who talked to the owner, and then they vanished down into one of the lower rooms.
Were you then taking up positions in there?
Then we were taking up positions.
What was your position?
Well, we were overlooking the entrance of the bridge, and there was a little action in the as night fell. There was some Germans making their way across the bridge, which we fired at from our windows.
With what result?
I believe there were one or two hits, because we heard one or two, you know, screams and shouts. But it was, you know, we were firing fairly in the dark, fairly blank there.
So what was the objective of all this?
Well, to as far as I can make out, the objective was to stop any real... Germans converging and holding on to the bridge.
And then?
Then what happened the next day? The next day we started going from house to house fighting. And things got a little bit hectic. We took up positions in other houses, and there was a, once again, things really started to liven up. Then there was a lot of action in the town by the church. One or two, the other battalions were fighting round. It was only the A Company that actually got to the bridge. The other battalions were fighting round, and there were armoured cars on fire, and there was quite a lot of chaos then. This went on all day and all night, and this was the second day. On the third day, during that time, a Tiger tank had made its way to these houses and started shooting through the houses. I can recall shells going right the way through the house. There were one or two casualties there. Well, we're up to the third day now. Fighting continued through that day. And on the third or fourth day, we were once again instructed to take a house. My sergeant, Ballinger, had been wounded, so I was leading the platoon. And we were fighting our way into another house, and there was one of the most remarkable thing to this day. I can see the chap at the top of the stairs. He was firing with an automatic weapon. If it had caught me, it would have cut me in half, but he was obviously firing wide. One shot got me in the shoulder, which went in there and out, which would have been a nice clean wound, but it, in going through there, it took, I now know it was a brachial plexus. All the nerve center was damaged with this bullet, and my arm was, you know, absolutely useless. I couldn't move my arm at all. I had to lift it. Anyhow, that's afterwards. I was completely knocked out and unconscious for a little while. My very good chum, Bill Roberts, who was just behind me, patched me up, dragged me to the side, out of the way. But by the way, I think the platoon finished off the Germans that were at the top of the stairs. I was dragged away, and Bill Roberts put dressings on, and we were all issued with little files of morphia. He gave me those, and I believe the Germans, a white flag was shown, and the Germans allowed the dead and wounded to be taken to a Red Cross post.
And so you had been hit in the left shoulder, and the bullet came out of your left side.
Yes, and apart from damaging all the nerves here, it missed my lungs by a fraction. And that is that. Now then,
Before you take it any further, if I can just go back to the fighting that you had been in.
Yeah.
Had you been in very much personal fighting before that?
Quite a bit of door-to-door fighting. House-to-house fighting.
What was that like?
Oh, it was you know, pretty daunting. But when you're in circumstances like this, I believe you think of nothing else. You know, your mind is taken up with... Not that we were brave or anything, but that there was so much going on that the mind could take in nothing else. There was no time to be frightened, because you can only be frightened if you're thinking, can't you? So there was nobody was actually scared. The only scared part, there was one sergeant when we were, I'm going back again now, before I was hit, when we were in a top story, when the Tiger tanks started to put a few shells through the house, one sergeant did go quite berserk. And I can't remember, he was an Irishman, but I cannot recall his name. But that was just a passing incident. Otherwise, there was... the thing that frightened me most was in case they brought in flamethrowers. But they didn't in this occasion. Why? I just don't know.
In what way did the chap go berserk?
Oh, when the shells started, I think he was an old campaigner, and I think his nerve just went.
Who was getting the better of this house-to-house fighting?
For a time, I think we were.